This show is part of the RetroZap.com podcast network.
This is Warp Trails, a Star Trek Discovery podcast, a RetroZap podcast network exclusive. Welcome to Warp Trails, the RetroZap podcast network show devoted to Star Trek. Tonight, we are continuing our coverage of the second scene Discovery with our recap and review of Episode 4, An Obol for Chiron. I'm Dennis Keithley, and I'm here with my wife and co-host Beth.
Hello, everyone. How are you?
So before we get into the episode, I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about carpool karaoke.
Oh, yes.
So if you missed it, the cast of Discovery was featured in a recent edition of the carpool karaoke segment. It was just a lot of fun.
It was just funny. There's only one singer in that group, and that is fine. Yes. And, you know, he was a professional Broadway actor, so it's good that he could sing. No one was horrible. I mean, it was funny. And I think that's what karaoke ought to be. You need to have one singer, and then everyone else is just having a good time.
Yeah, I know Mary Weissman had done some off-Broadway stuff, as she alludes to in the course of the skit, so she sang okay.
I think there were a couple times where I felt like she was purposefully being bad.
Well, yeah, and then Doug Jones was purposely being ridiculous.
Yes.
At times, but it was just a lot of fun, because it starts off with them on the Discovery, getting ready to go to a break or lunch or whatever, and Sonequa Martin-Jones says, you know, hey, do you all have plans? And they're like, yeah, what? And then they go onto the transporter pad, and the next thing they know, they're in a car in Toronto,
driving around Toronto.
And I thought it was especially fun when they were trying to get people to do the Live Long and Prosper.
Yes, the Vulcan salute. Oh, it's a great 15 minutes. If you've got 15 minutes, it's an excellent way to spend 15 minutes.
Yeah, but you can find links to this all over Twitter and Facebook. And I think it's available, the full clip is available through iTunes.
Yeah, it's an Apple TV ad.
There you go. That's right. But anyway, so highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. Check that out. So let's get into our review. And as with every show, this is a full spoiler discussion. So if you're still here, you're listening at your own peril. There's, like last week's episode, there's kind of three storylines going on. I haven't broken them down individually because they kind of do tie together a little bit.
They overlap, especially at the end.
Yeah, they tie together a little bit better than the three stories from the last episode did. So we'll just, I kind of pulled them apart a little bit, but let's just start at the beginning. The Discovery ends up with a lead on Spock's shuttle, and this comes to be because number one arrives and gives Pike what he needs. Beth, who is number one?
Number one is the original first officer as part of the original pilot, which was re-shown as a original series episode called The Cage.
First officer of the Enterprise.
She is the under Pike. She never has a name beyond number one. She seemed to be hopelessly in love with Pike, not in Discovery, but in the episode of The Cage. And also, I always felt was trying to out Vulcan Spock. Now, you know, we only see her for bits and parts of a one episode, but it is a call out. And at the time was very significant that you would have a female. And God, I sound like a Ferengi when I say that. I'm sorry. When you have a woman as the first officer of a starship, that was a very big deal at the time.
And it was originally, she was played by Majel Barrett?
Yes, who also is known for being Nurse Chapel, the voice of the Enterprise computer, for being Loxana Troi.
She was also the computer of the Enterprise in The Next Generation, wasn't she?
Yes, but she was Loxana Troi on both The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine.
Right. And then Rebecca Romijn played her on Discovery.
Yes.
So that was cool. But anyway, so she
has a really good order, like way to go on the food order. I was
Her burger and fries.
Yeah, not the shake, but clearly has ordered a shake before. I was like, yay! And our older son pointed out that the order was not commented on by the food maker thing.
Replicator.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, no snark from the replicator this time around. But she's shown up because she's been digging into Spock's disappearance as well, which I think speaks well of Spock, that the entire crew of the Enterprise is a little shaken up by what has happened to him. And no one is buying the story about him murdering the doctors and making a run for it and having gone crazy. But she's, she shows up and she hands over some information to Pike. And that's basically what we get from her
right
in this episode. Then Pike goes to his ready room where we have Burnham and Saru and other members of the bridge crew meeting.
Yeah.
Including Linus.
Now,
it occurred to me that we completely neglected to mention Linus in our review of the first episode of the season.
Well, he does just sneeze on a guy.
Yeah, but it was hysterical.
Oh, no, it's hysterical, and I would love to see more of him.
Yeah.
Linus is the Saurian who... Mm-hmm.
Has four sinus cavities.
So you can imagine getting a cold is horrible. So when Saru says he has a cold, Linus is unbelievably sympathetic to
the cause. And he sneezed all over the mansplaining science officer from the Enterprise.
Who then ate an asteroid. So.
Right. But he gets to talk in this one. The translator on the ship has a little bit of a trouble interpreting him. And it is a little difficult to hear him and understand him.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it may be deliberate, but I could have done with them making him a bit clearer for this. I mean, I get what they were going for.
And it was important later in the episode.
Yeah, but still, I mean, they already do enough of this business. Like we talked about last week when Burnham and Amanda were talking, it was quiet and hard to hear.
Yeah.
And now you got a character who's just hard to understand.
I'm just wondering if Linus is going to be like a foreshadower of things to come.
Yeah, it could be. But so he's there. Saru's there and he's sick. He believes he's experiencing a cold. But then Pike shows up and says, hey, we got a lead on Spock. Let's go. Burnham informs him that perhaps she should kind of be kept out of the loop where Spock is concerned because she's afraid that her presence on such a mission would further irritate Spock or make things worse.
Yeah, in an episode that I really, really enjoyed, this Burnham and Spock and, oh, there's no Spock and we're never going to see Spock and Burnham is going to angst about Spock is making me crazy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They need to rip off this bandage of Spock.
Yeah, definitely. So they go to warp and not long after they do, they get pulled out by a gigantic orb that is both, it's part organic and not organic, and it's in distress and it's kind of got them locked in place. And it's about, I think they describe it as 350 miles wide, and they determine that it's about 100,000 years old.
Yes, I was sure it was similar to the Planet Eater from the Star Trek original series, the Doomsday Machine, Doomsday Device. I think it's Doomsday Machine. I think I'm wrong. In fact, there's nothing that leads me to believe that that's true. But they look alike.
Yeah, I remembered when that first came on screen, you made that remark.
I yelled Planet Eater, and everyone was very excited.
Yeah. But not only does it pull them out of warp, it immediately infects them with a virus, which has a really funny way of manifesting itself because Pike and Burnham are talking to each other and all of a sudden they're speaking Klingon. And it's infected the universal translator. And then on the bridge, people are speaking Chinese, Spanish. They're speaking like all these random languages every few seconds.
It gives you an idea. First of all, it gives you an idea of the complexity of the Enterprise or the Discovery computer and just the computer in general, in that not only does it has to know all these languages, but the it was just cool. I mean, you got this sense of like how many languages could be on the ship, and at one point Saru comes on and Pike says, "Welcome to the Tower of Babel," but I was like, no, I mean, yes, but it's so cool. Mm-hmm. It was That wasn't my favorite scene, but that was one of mine because that was just really cool to see how they did that and just to listen to it even when you didn't understand what was going on.
All right, but Saru's ability to speak 94 languages, which he did when he was at Starfleet Academy, comes into play here, and he's able to read all the computers, which nobody else can.
That was funny because when they first mentioned it, he's such a like that guy at Star. Yeah. You're like, you were that guy in school who learns 94 languages, but it becomes really critically important for this episode that he does.
Yeah, and I can't remember what it was in this episode, but he makes a point of saying it's like, you know, he's this Kelpian, he's the first one in Starfleet, he's trying to prove himself and that he belongs, and that's why he went to the trouble to learn all these languages. And it's a nice bit of his backstory. We actually get a fair amount of Kelpian backstory in this episode, which we'll get to.
We should just say we are not going to touch on the short track that is all about his backstory.
That's an upcoming episode when we have more time.
Right. But if you haven't seen it, there's a lot that will help you with this episode, but it's not necessary, which is why we're not going to discuss it.
Right. Carry on. But the Lorbas kind of got them locked in place. Like I said, it's infected the ship with a virus that's universal translator is the first thing to go, but then it's also locked down parts of the ship. And at this point, it's Saru realizes he's not really experiencing the cold, that he has begun I think they pronounced it Vahari, yeah, which is in his species signals that it's time for them to be culled and slaughtered. Because on their world, they are a prey species. And that's why they have this threat ganglia. When they get to this point, it's time for them to die. And if they don't, he describes it as essentially in a dementia and an Alzheimer's-like state. They go insane and death was preferable.
Right.
So we've got the fate of the ship and the fate of Saru at stake here. And if that is not enough, when we get to engineering, Tilly and Stamets are having problems with Rome. They get locked in, first of all. And it just so happens that Jet Reno from the first episode is there.
Yes. And nice to see her. It was nice to see her back.
Now, she and Stamets, I wouldn't exactly say, they didn't hit it off. But
what is the exact opposite of hitting it?
So they're both engineers, they're both scientists, they both have in a completely different way of doing it. She's old school, I think, is the best way to think of it. You know, she's very much into warp drive and dilithium crystals
and duct tape.
And duct tape. And then he is all about the future and finding the next version of renewable energy.
But how much did you know? That was a really passionate fight about like environmentalism, mm-hmm, and you kind of knew.
We were just speculating about these spores an episode or two ago.
Yeah.
That their use of them is probably polluting whatever this environment is. And that's why at some point in the future, we're not going to be seeing the spore drive used anymore. But I loved her jokes because, you know, she kept coming back with, well, I can fix that with duct tape. That analogy with duct tape.
She did say she was uninsultable, and she did prove it.
That is true. She fixed something with chewing gum.
At one point. She did grape chewing gum.
Yeah, because Tilly had grape chewing gum sitting there at the bridge. But once they're locked into engineering, they realize that there's a buildup of energy and electricity in one area. They're compartment has got enough ionization in it that they're at risk of all getting electrocuted to death. And therefore they got to do something about it so that they create a gas filled.
They
did a good job explaining the science of this one.
They MacGyver it.
But they filled a hose, for lack of a better description, with gas and stretch it from one end of engineering to the other. And then they're going to run the electric current from there. They do that, but it causes a blowback, a blast, and it ends up unwittingly unleashing the spore creature May that they pulled out of Tilly from the last one, and it wastes no time
lobbing
onto Tilly's arm.
Yes.
And so they have to quarantine her. So we're kind of going to keep going with her story a little bit here. Poor Tilly.
Poor Tilly.
So she's quarantined and May is pumping stuff into her. She's just kind of in and out of it.
She's stoned.
Yeah. And so what they finally decide is that they need to, what is the device they were using? But they're going to try and figure out, they figure they can talk to May through Tilly.
Yes.
And so they first try setting up this device outside the quarantine cell, and it doesn't really work. And so they pull her out, strap her to a platform, and they figure out that they've got to put this little device in her head.
Old school with a drill.
Yeah, because they have no surgical equipment. They have no anesthesia. And so Stamets asks Tilly to sing her favorite song,
which is Space Oddity by David Bowie,
which also came up during Carpool Karaoke.
Yes.
And, you know, so he starts singing with her, and then at the last second, he zaps her with the drill. And I'm glad they did that from behind, because that gave me the willies.
Not great. Yeah. I mean, it worked out fine, but I was like, please don't lobotomize Tilly.
Right. But so this works. They get this translation device implanted right there in the side of Tilly's head. It's this little tiny thing. I was expecting some sort of a Borg-looking apparatus on the side of her face or whatever, because we have the cyborg that's on the bridge.
Yeah.
But it's not that. So May comes to the forefront, and she pretty much confirms what we were saying, that the
spore drive broke their environment.
Right. Stamets is the captain that she was referring to in the past episode. When he flies Discovery in there, it's polluting their environment. It's killing their species. I think they call them the Jacelle or something like that. There's so much dialogue and so much jargon that comes out that it's hard to follow all this.
But Stamets apologized. He says he's going to do better.
Right. And he knows better.
And he knows better.
And so Tilly then gets cocooned by this thing.
Yeah, it eats Tilly.
Right. And so Stamets and Jet end up yanking her out. And that's a short-lived solution. Before this cocoon-like May, I guess, launches spores at them. They start getting loopy. They're you could tell they're like on a bad trip.
Yep.
Because of the way they're looking at each other, it's all distorted. And Stamets ends up telling Jet to hit
him. Slap him.
Yeah, slap him. And so she does. And it was enough to snap him out of it long enough for him to inoculate them against these spores. And that's pretty much the Tilly story. She ends up back in the cocoon.
She's gone. Yeah. I mean, she's gone and has been kidnapped by May.
Right. And so we know from the preview of the next episode that that's what the next episode is going to be about, but that's kind of a cliffhanger there. But back on the bridge, Saru and Burnham have been having a lot of these heartfelt conversations about, their relationship and Burnham, Saru's mortality. Mm-hmm. And he's basically said that, ever since he got into Starfleet, he's been keeping a log. And this is where we start to find out some interesting things about his species. He's essentially a refugee from his planet.
Right.
And they are not a spacefaring species.
No.
So they're subject to General Order 1, which is the prime directive, and he can't go back.
Right. Basically, Georgiou took him off the planet, gave him refugee status, and she didn't personally process, but took him to Starbase 7 with the understanding that because they are not, she was going to protect him, but because General Order 1 applies to the rest of the planet. So Saru can't go home.
Right. But his hope is that at someday when General Order 1 doesn't apply, he asks Burnham to honor him by bringing back his logs to them so that his people, the Kelpians, can realize that what's available to them, that they
right.
can, that this type, they are capable of joining Starfleet and being more than this prey species.
Yes.
A lot of heartfelt moments between the two of those, but
really well acted by them both.
Yeah, it really was. And one of the things I know you and I have remarked about this in the past is that the crew likes each other this season. They aren't at odds. They aren't competing with each other. We had, last season Burnham, got busted down to, she wasn't an officer. She wasn't a lieutenant. She wasn't a commander. She was a specialist, I think, assigned to Discovery after the War of the Klingons started. But she had been competing with Saru to eventually become the first officer on the Shinzo. And they were kind of competing with each other to be Georgiou's favorite. And now Saru outranks her on the Discovery as essentially the first officer. But there's no longer that competition.
I think at this point, both Saru and Burnham because Burnham was the only human on Vulcan trying to compete with the Vulcans, mm-hmm. and Saru was the only Kelpian in Starfleet trying to prove his worth. And I think basically over the course of the first season, they both proved their self-worth to themselves. I'm sorry, that's an awkward sentence, but there it is. And so they can be friends because they're not competing because they realize they both successfully have their own place.
Right. And then there was that, there was also some resentment on Saru's part because he kind of felt that Burnham got Georgiou killed in that first season. And then when the will was meted out at the end of that first season and the telescope was left to Burnham, you know, Saru was jealous about that. But then Burnham said, no, this really belongs with you. And so they had bridged the gap there.
Yeah.
And this season, you know, she comes at, you know, I'm kind of blending a couple scenes together here for the purposes of the discussion. But, you know, she says that she's come to learn that they are family. And that's kind of a key component of any Star Trek series. What, you know, that the crew treats each other as a family as opposed to rivals. You know, Stamets was just a jerk in the first season. But now he's very fond of Tilly and the rest of the crew, for that matter.
Well, when you talk about Pike being protective of Spock and number one, trying to get the information so they can find Spock, there's that element there that the Enterprise has their family as well. So you're right. It's a very Starfleet, Star Trek notion of making your own family.
So eventually they come to the realization that this orb is dying, that it is some sort of sentient species that's dying, and it's alone in the galaxy. And what it's trying to do is convey a message to them so that it'll be remembered.
Right. Basically, it wants to do what Saru wants to have done, have its personal log remembered and cataloged. But the orb is speaking, communicating through ultraviolet light, which is not something that, you know,
most of the people on the crew can...
The Discovery is like, oh, of course, ultraviolet light communication.
Because Saru keeps having... His visual spectrum permits him to see ultraviolet rays.
Yes.
And he keeps having these flashes of it. And to him, at first, that was a sickness. That's part of his sickness, it's part of his illness. But then he realizes that's not the case. And he changes the screen on the Discovery to demonstrate that. And they see all these weird patterns that they determine are the communication from the orb.
Yes.
And so they finally convince Pike...
Who's ready to shoot it.
And they determined that the weapons would melt before it even got to the orb in the first place. So the idea is that they're going to eject the warp core and detonate it and use it to propel themselves away from the orb. And they're getting ready to do this when Burnham and Saru show up and say, no, yeah, listen, we got to drop the shields. We need to let it finish its communication. And that should take care of everything. Well, they're literally running out of time because not only is the orb about to blow up, but they're minutes away from losing Spock's signature.
Yeah, the warp shuttle signature. It's going to be out of sensor range.
But it works. So they drop the shields, they get the transmission, and then the orb before it destructs, before it dies, it
pushes
them clear of the explosion so that they're safe. And so that works. But unfortunately, now Saru is determined that it's his time.
Yes.
And so Burnham is helping him back to his quarters where he's going to die. Very touching scene. Everyone on the bridge.
Including Pike,
just stands up. And it was kind of an emotional episode.
It was a really emotional episode.
And it felt earned. It did not feel forced. You know, I think over the last episode or two of the first season and just three episodes, they really did a good job of cementing that family atmosphere on the show. Which, as we've just been discussing, was lacking for most of that first, you know, it was the first season with 15 episodes. And for 12 or 13 of those people liked each other.
Right. They were all barking at each other.
They were all rivals and now they're a family again. So it was heartfelt. They're back in Saru's quarters and he basically gets a ceremonial knife and he gives it to Burnham. And I guess this assisted suicide works that she severs his ganglia, which allows him to pass.
Right, that's what's supposed to happen.
And Saru gets a promise from Burnham that she will do everything she can to reconcile with Spock.
Yes.
Because Saru had to abandon his sister and he's never going to be able to get back to his homeworld to see her and tell her about all the things that he's done.
Yes.
And he doesn't want Burnham to lose that opportunity. And this goes back into that whole family conversation they have. So Burnham promises that she'll do that. But then when she finally gets up the nerves to sever the ganglia, they shrivel up and fall off on their own.
Right. But this was cool. Okay. There have been several, and I know there's a Next Generation episode where Worf is paralyzed and he wants to die and he wants Riker to help kill him. And the whole episode is about, it's a great episode and I do recommend you watch it, but it's about what's Riker's responsibility to Worf. And I was, when this started, I was like, okay, we're going to have flashbacks to this, but the honor and the respect and the love, I mean, Burnham does not want to,
she's sobbing.
She's sobbing, yeah. And she is broken, but she's going to do it. Like, she's going to be brave and she's going to do it. This is the request and she's going to do it. And what I really liked about how they did this, how the writers did it, was that she was going to do it. Like, Burnham, I think, gets points for honoring her promise to Saru. Mm-hmm. The fact that she didn't have to cut them because they fell off on their own is great because she didn't have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But she would have. And I think that's moving forward. I think we're not going to have episodes where Saru is like, I can't believe you wouldn't do that or anything like that, because she would have done it.
Well, he doesn't even realize what's happened. He thought she'd done it, but then, you know, she drops the knife. She's like, well, it did it on its own. I didn't do it. It did it on its own.
Right.
And so,
like, I barely touched them; they fell off.
Yeah, but it was a nice bonding moment, for lack of a better description. But they, you know, so then they go to sick bay, and the doctor determines that he's in perfect health. In fact, better than ever. His anxiety is essentially gone. He's feeling empowered by this, and he realizes, I can't remember. Did they name the species that preyed on the Kelpians, or not?
I don't think they did in this episode. They did in Short Trek, and it's escaping me at the moment.
But basically, they determined that this other species is essentially got the Kelpians believing that they are this prey species, that this, the Vahari, is a signal to them that they need to submit to the slaughter and everything else. And it's a complete lie.
Right.
That,
you know, their truth, the Kelpians have a truth, and it's wrong. And so the question Saru has is, what is his obligation now that he knows that this truth is not real?
Right. And of course, that runs right up against General Order 1.
Yeah.
Because he can't go back and explain it to him without violating the Prime Directive. So that seems to me that we've got a future episode outlined for us right there.
I've really enjoyed this season, how they're taking, there's three at least, very traditional Trek stories in this episode, right?
Right.
The thing that they don't understand that may or may not be trying to kill them. The crew member about to die.
An alien infestation.
Alien infestation. General Order 1. Is it good? Is it bad? But the way Discovery kind of plays with these, I really like.
And then the old science versus the new science, and the, you know, the smug belief that the new science is superior when in fact it's got its own problems.
Right.
And so, and you know, like we mentioned earlier, they tease that as the next episode, that they're having to deal with the mycelial network.
Well, and to go back to that, one of the things they do to sort of fix themselves is that Pike announces that all the holographic communication have to get pulled out of the Enterprise because it's messing up the ship. And he's like, fine, we're going to go back to screens.
Right. Nice and little retcon.
I was like, okay, that's
why we don't have holo emitters on the Enterprise when Discovery had them.
Yeah.
You know, so many years earlier. Yeah. Which was a nice little touch there. But then, so Saru's going to live, which we were all happy to see, because we were all getting a little concerned. I mean, you knew in the back of your mind that he was going to be okay, that they weren't going to kill off a key player 4 episodes into the second season. And it got so far, you know, it got so close as to Burnham about to...
Were you so sure?
But then, I mean, there had been nothing about Doug Jones leaving the show.
I guess that's true, but Doug Jones is such a character actor that I was like, oh crap, he's got some role somewhere and he's gotten pulled off.
But he made it. And it was tense. You know, our 11-year-old was beside himself as we were watching this. But so Saru's good, he's gonna make it, and then we have a final meeting between Pike and Burnham. He is reviewing this log of 100,000 years of data, which the universal translator is starting to interpret for them. And I can't remember what event it was talking about, but he was listening to this recording from the orb, and then you know, Burnham's in there essentially to apologize that this cost them the opportunity to find Spock. But then Pike points out, well, not so fast. You know, the as part of its last bit of data, the orb gave us a glimpse of the galaxy, and we know exactly where Spock is. So let's get on it. And Pike makes the comments like, well, you know, I'll figure out how to route you out of this. And then she says, no, you know, I need to be involved with Spock, and I, you know, I need to repair this relationship. And so she vows that she'll be part of the solution.
Yep.
Okay. And that's our episode. So, overall, what'd you think?
It was good. There was a lot in that episode. I liked the pacing. It did move through quickly. There's a lot of stuff we just skipped over about digital antibiotics and how they, or antibodies and how they fix the computer.
That was a key part.
Star Trek sciences it up, and they scienced it up, and there were some cool bits, you know, on the bridge, and it was a good episode, but a lot happened in that episode. I am, as I said at the front of this episode, I will say it again at the end, I am getting tired of chasing down Spock.
Mm-hmm.
I think the writers are overestimating our excitement over Spock, as opposed to our, please don't screw this up, please don't screw this up, please don't screw this up, which...
And we're not going to get Spock next episode either. Next episode is all about saving Tilly and dealing with what's going on with the mycelial network and the species that's been harmed over there. And we know Section 31 shows up. We got that tease and that. So we know Spock's not going to be in the next episode either.
At some point, we're going to have to deal with the Kelpians.
The Super Bowl just had an ad featuring Spock.
The screen when you go to All Access is Burnham and Spock.
And so it's it is feeling a bit like a bait and switch right now on this. And I'm with you. It's the search for Spock and these red signals and the red angel are kind of the MacGuffin that's keeping us going through the season, that's tying the season together. That wasn't such a thing, I don't think, with the original series and the Next Generation, but then...
Oh, no, those were so episodic.
But Voyager and Deep Space Nine had, along, they had these season-long arcs, and then Enterprise did as well.
For sure.
And so they're kind of doing that, you know, season one was kind of two main story arcs, the Klingon and then the Terran Empire invasion, and then this one has got these stories in the background, but we've had these episodic things that have happened, and that pleases me. I like that.
Oh, for sure.
You know, you don't absolutely have to know that all about these red angels and the signals in order to enjoy these episodes for the most part. But that being said, it's like, okay, quit teasing me about Spock. Let's get to Spock and let's get that taken care of.
Right.
So, or at least start to get that taken care of.
Which isn't, I hate to obsess about it. Like, it's four episodes into this season and it's like, you know, at some point, you know, let's chill. But, you know, they'll get there. But it's just... The marketing of this season versus the actual reality of it. Because this is a good episode.
Mm-hmm.
And really, if you think about it, you know, it's like we're trying to chase down Spock because we want to figure out what's going on. We're looking for the shuttle.
Right.
Like, Pike doesn't super harp about it, but...
But at this point, they've built up this mystery now across four episodes with what's going on with the signals, what's going on with the Red Angel. It really needs to have a big payoff. And I'm getting legitimately concerned that it won't, that it's going to be a letdown when we get there. And, you know, perhaps, perhaps they've got something in store that's going to blow our minds.
Well, I would love to be proven wrong.
Yeah. But,
but what did you think of this episode?
I love this episode.
This was good. There was a lot going on here.
We've seen this type of story before where they encounter some sort of an alien life form that's not humanoid that they have to figure out how to deal with. I can't remember what the name of the episode was, Next Generation, where they created a suture in order to fix this creature they were stuck inside of.
Yeah.
And then blast it out. We've had episodes of Enterprise where they're getting sucked into something like a black hole and they ended up basically had to quit fighting it and just fly through.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had these situations where you're dealing with the alien life form that's not the, you know, doesn't have two arms, two legs, and looks vaguely humanoid. And then the situation is like, we're stuck and we have to figure out how to get unstuck. This was kind of a blend of those stories. And it didn't feel like, you know, it didn't feel like identical to those. And I like that. It took an old idea and made it feel fresh.
Sure.
I think the tone of this season, again, continues to prove to be superior to last season's. And I think it's just the circumstances. They, you know, a lot of shows take a season to find their footing. And I don't think The Next Generation wasn't any different.
Well,
and Deep Space Nine wasn't any different.
Deep Space Nine almost needed three seasons.
Right. It wasn't until they really added Worf and got the battle with the Dominion going that show, I think, really found its pacing.
Yeah.
And perhaps they went a little too long, but that's another discussion for another day.
That's another podcast.
But
that's another show.
Right. But overall, no, I thought this was a great episode. I still think, you know, perhaps the second episode of the season, A New Eden, is my favorite one that we've had so far. This might be second, I think, of the four.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like the first episode, but yeah, I mean, with the reference to, you know, coins for the dead, there was not nearly as depressing as I thought it was going to be.
Right. But an obol for Chiron is the coins that you would give the boatman for the River Styx.
Yes.
Is that Greek or Roman mythology?
Greek.
Greek. When you know, since you could pass into the Hades and the afterlife. And so that was, and very appropriate title, considering
very appropriate title.
What was happening to the Orb and Saru there. But any other thoughts, or are we going to wrap this up?
I think we're good.
All right.
Oh, but if you want to find us, oh, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. We are on Discord. You want to talk about Discord for a minute?
Yeah, and we've been having fun there. We've been having, not a lot, but we've had a few people that have shown up in Discord and started talking to us about these episodes, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And even if you're not interested in talking about Discovery and Star Trek, there's plenty of other channels there. We have a general geek topic discussion channel. There's channels for all the other shows there, including my Starship Sailors and Scoundrels podcast. It's all about Star Wars. We got a lot going on there. We have had fun discussions going about the DC universe with the CW shows.
And there's a DC chat room spoiler, so if you want to like really talk about,
you've been active in there.
Yeah, I have. I have.
You've been having fun. Yeah.
I have opinions
because you are a big Flash fan.
I am a big Flash fan.
So definitely go check that out.
So go check it out. So we're back on Discord. We're active on Discord. We can also be reached on Twitter at Warp Trails, on Instagram and Facebook at Warp Trails Pod. And we can be reached by email at warptrails@retrozap.com.
And we'd love to get your emails. And if we get some good ones, we'll definitely be sharing them on the show.
Yes.
So, and our show is part of the RetroZap Podcast Network. Head over to RetroZap.com for other great podcasts such as the Deucecast Movie Show, Star Wars shows such as Brews and Blasters, Beltway Banthas, and Kanata's Castle, and as I said earlier, my show, Starship Sabers and Scoundrels, the superhero suite of Green Justice, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, and Scarlet Velocity. There's Dorklayer for Collectors, Techno Retro Dads, the Animaniacs, the Dunecast, We Know Nothing for the Game of Thrones fans, and the Ardcast for those of you that are into video games. And our theme music is Wasp from Faces by Misha Dixon, which is available on the Free Music Archive. So thanks for joining us, everyone. Live long and prosper, and we'll talk to you next time.
Remember, you can probably fix it with duct tape. Thank you.